I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
So, this Brutal House is a protest novel, I see it as, and it's set against the sort of backdrop. It's set in New York against a backdrop of the sort of voguing ball scene. So the book starts on the steps of City Hall in New York, and there's five aging mothers, and by mothers I mean the founders of the ball houses, the voguing houses in New York, who have decided after a sort of late religious conversion to start a silent protest. And basically they're protesting against the disappearance of children from their houses over the years, whether through homophobic, transphobic violence, poverty, whatever. And over the years they've tried to address those disappearances in many different ways, through legal channels, through political ways, through more vocal protests, and nothing's really happened. So this is the day where they decide that actually a protest where they don't speak and they are going to represent themselves as literally a physical mass until they get the answers they want is what's going to happen. And that's basically what sets up the whole book. So what I'm going to read from it for you is a really early part from the novel, which sort of... Also, the other thing I should say to you is it is written in a collective voice, so they are known as we. So it's very much about I wanted to basically have a voice that spoke as like as one consciousness, almost that it was like a sort of unwritten sort of social history in a way. So they basically don't speak pretty much throughout the whole novel, so all you hear is this one collective voice. So what I'm going to read is a section where they're sort of explaining how they got to the point where they decided that they would do this protest as a silent protest. We reached our position through trial and error, wasted years adhering to the official channels of complaint, registering our dissent through community action and the ballot box, years of putting faith into the power of statistics at the ballot box, how power could be swayed by tipping the balance in marginal precincts, our energy focused on the campaign trail, believing that it was in our power to inform and persuade. When that failed, we attempted direct action. We recognised that we didn't have decades to regroup politically, nor did we have the taste for it, patronised and belittled, forced into a ghetto they viewed as essential to our enlightenment. Taking to the streets in the spirit of our community organising and activist forebears, an arsenal of placards and loudspeakers, baseball bats and rocks. Their thinking was that we would fear the rows of turned out riot police, military in their bearing, but as threatening as country barn dancers. That tear gas would contain us when we'd lived with nightclub smoke machines most of our adult lives and learned to see how to see past the mist. We were pissed and no longer afraid. We finally had use for the bodies we'd spent so long starving and pumping. We learned the power of our physical strength. All that we'd shied away from as children we discovered now. How far a rock can be thrown by a single hand. The furthest we could run when chased. The speed at which our blood glucose was assimilated after physical exertion. The power of our voices. The solidity of our fists. Battles on our neighbourhood street corners, blood spilling onto the steps of our markets and dry cleaners. We took pleasure in learning that a punch landing correctly upon soft flesh is a tangible result, one that cannot be discounted as an ineligible vote by righteous town hall staff or lost in city administration paperwork lodged amongst stacks of other investigations. We understood how fear could be successfully employed to our ends if we remained consistent in both our actions and our number, that we were not the weaker party in these episodes. Our knowledge of the streets, our physical prowess and the force of our anger propelled us further than we would have otherwise dared. We found success through rioting, making our dissatisfaction known, but effecting prolonged change was harder still. We were not prepared. What we'd not factored on was how our spirit would be weakened by a sustained assault on our home streets, how it was impossible to switch off, smoke and blood trailing our movements, the imprint of a gloved fist sending us to sleep atop our battlefields. The owner of the dry cleaners, for example, beaten by the police, mistaking him for one of us, but not the us they were thinking of. Our voice was strong, but there was nothing healthy in our attitude, often ready to turn on each other rather than concede a slight against the opposing side. Long after the police lines dispersed and our long-cherished complaints were addressed, we remained ghoul-like in our ghettos, fighting our shadow. Only through prayer did we remember ourselves and our capabilities.
So, that's so beautiful, by the way. So my book is about the mainstreaming of queer culture, basically, in a sentence, but it's particularly about the ambivalence I was personally feeling a couple of years ago about things like same-sex marriage and more heteronormative choices and wanting to live a more kind of queer or radical life, and really feeling like I was caught between this binary and I had to choose between these things. So I link that to wider queer culture and basically this moment we're living in where we have all these new freedoms and choices, and LGBT culture has never been so mainstream. So we have same-sex marriage, we have drag race being watched in all these different countries, we have big banks sponsoring Pride, and I think we're kind of at this strange moment where we have this sort of decision to make about whether to assimilate or whether to sort of hold on to something more subversive or radical or underground about queer culture. So the book is really my exploration of that and whether we do in fact need to choose. And the bit I'm going to read you is from a chapter called In the Beginning There Were Gay Bars. It's about the place I was at when I really first started thinking about the book, which was when in the early 2000s, a lot of the gay bars I used to go to started closing one by one. And I'd spent so much time in these bars, and like they were really where I found myself. And I wanted to know why they were closing and like what some of the reasons were. So I'm going to read you a little bit from that. And I think it explains some of my motivation when I initially started thinking about writing the book and thinking about the mainstreaming of queer culture. A few weeks after I returned from LA, I found myself sitting in a circle of people in a drafty London warehouse. We started by going around the group, sharing our name, our pronouns, and why we were there. Some were first-timers who had read about the campaign online and explained that they were looking to do more activism. Then there were the core members, who'd been going to the meetings for 3 years. I was there as a journalist, I said, who was thinking of writing an article to raise awareness about the campaign, which was true, but I was also short on work. Things had been looking up for me in my personal life since Iceland and LA. I was still dating Emily, the lawyer, crying less while she was asleep next to me. And although I wasn't totally sure that I was ready for anything as serious as what I'd had with Salka, we continued hanging out. Something about the relationship just felt promising. But work-wise, I was listless and still out of a full-time job. So I had decided to throw myself into writing about LGBTQ issues again. Only now I was regretting it. Sitting across from me was someone I'd ended things with on the third date 4 years ago, her eyes boring into my soul. We were there at the meeting to talk about resurrecting my favourite gay bar, the Joiner's Arms, a now defunct but legendary place. A grimy, one-storey, one-room bar-cum-club with a pool table in the centre that had made it look like a depraved youth club. It opened in 1997 and had been going for 12 years when I first arrived. Although I knew people like the designer Alexander McQueen and photographer Wolfgang Tillmans had long since partied within its four walls, I never felt I'd missed the zeitgeist, not even when it was near empty on karaoke Tuesdays. I remember Beth Ditto from The Gossip turning up at the Joiners and singing at karaoke. My friends trying to chat up the gay members of the XX, which isn't to emphasize its celebrity cachet, but to illustrate the fact that it put everyone on an equal playing field. It was famously cheap, welcoming, and uninhibited. The air always felt thick with possibility, as well as the odor of sweat and testosterone. It was a male-dominated space, although transgender matriarch Stephanie always propped up the bar, and Sunday nights were full of women. Between the pub itself and the local all-hours after-parties, you could spend most of your weekend in or around the Joiners, emerging wide-eyed on Monday morning in an outfit that had somehow seemed like a good idea on Friday night. And I did. Between 2009 and 2012, I went to the Joiners Arms along with one or two other gay bars pretty much every weekend. The blueprint was always the same. I would arrive already drunk, probably with one gay male friend and one straight girlfriend who'd been pissed off that she'd lost by majority rule and been dragged along. Then we'd swiftly get drunker to acclimatise. Then, as these were the days before dating apps, we would survey the room, our cruising ground, or even circle it, depending on the floor plan that evening, looking for people we might be attracted to. Sometimes I'd ask my straight friend to flirt with me to drum up attention. Over the course of the evening, we would work up the courage to hit on people. 4 out of 5 times the attempt would fail, and I'd leave with my gay male friend, the straight one having left out of boredom hours ago. On the night bus or on the walk home, we'd lament the fact that no one but each other wanted to accompany us, a ritual that brought us closer together. Sometimes we'd go into another club to continue the party, like East Block, an underground techno and house club near Old Street with Keith Haring-esque paintings on its black walls and a labyrinth of corridors and rooms. The only place I've ever taken drugs that I found on the floor. I really just wanted to read that bit in the LRB. The Joiners closed in January 2015, after property developers snapped up the land. A lot like Brooklyn in New York, Hackney was an area of London that had become increasingly expensive since artists, gallerists, and fashion designers took advantage of the comparatively cheap rent there in the 90s and 2000s. The bar wasn't struggling for customers. It was full every weekend until its dying day. It just got priced out. The elderly landlord, David Pollard, had rented the building from a brewery. And when the brewery sold the land to property developers, he was informed that his lease was not going to be renewed. It turned out that developers had also purchased the adjacent buildings on the street and planned to turn the site into a block of luxury flats. These flats would contribute to the shiny, new gentrified facade of Hackney, a process that saw locally owned businesses replaced with chain restaurants and hip coffee shops, while low-income families living in the surrounding council houses were also priced out. In the years between 2006 and 2016, London became a gay bar graveyard. In this decade, 58% of London's gay bars closed their doors, compared with 44% of non-LGBTQ plus nightlife venues. I didn't really care so much about Candy Bar, one of the first I noticed to go, a gay bar for women in Soho that closed in January 2014 after a 50% rent increase, although it did look like a brilliant caricature of a lesbian bar, all glittery interiors and a clientele in fedora hats, like something off the TV show The L Word. Personally, I preferred mixed spaces and cared more about the closure of Escape and Madame Jojo's, two fun clubs next to one another in Soho. The former, a generic gay bar that could have been in any city in the UK, with its rainbow neon lights and pop chart playlist. The latter, an iconic drag and cabaret club that had been hosting more and more straight nights over the last few years for economic reasons. Soho, London's foremost gay neighbourhood, was the area suffering hardest, but there were closures all over the city. The Black Cap, a beloved drag pub in Camden, the Georgian Dragon, a gay pub in Shoreditch, and Hoist, an S&M club in Vauxhall. So many closed that it felt as though we lost another every couple of weeks. My gay friends grieved, while many of my straight fans failed to notice. Other cities were undergoing a similar transformation. In Manchester, the Queer as Hope folk heyday of the 1990s and early 2000s gave way to a spate of closures, including the popular bars Taurus and Eden. New York's Chelsea lost a number of its gay bars to drugstores and bank chains during the 2010s. And a similar thing happened in San Francisco, due in part to the invasion of the tech industry. Like San Francisco, the reason London seemed to be hit particularly hard was due to its high land value. In 2016, it became the city with the most expensive rents in Europe. Yes, many gay bars couldn't afford to hold ground, but with these high rents and a high cost of living, A lot of my friends couldn't afford to go to them quite so often either. However, the closure of London gay bars wasn't just down to the economic situation. Many argued that they were casualty of the cultural climate for LGBTQ plus people. Shortly after the Joiners shut up shop, I decided to start writing about the club closures for work, which, perhaps ironically, caused me to sober up and ask myself the bigger questions about what was happening to these places. In talking to LGBTQ people for the articles I wrote, a new idea emerged, that the physical gentrification of the city wasn't the full story, that our desire to go to gay clubs itself might be on the wane. If marriage rights and parenting rights were an upshot of our acceptance, the closure of gay bars might be the downside. After all, why would you need to go to gay bars if your sexuality no longer had to define you, or if you're at home looking after a baby?
Okay, so I'm going to read just a little bit from the beginning of my book as well. And I'm not going to say too much about it. As I said, it's like what they call like formally innovative fiction, but it's not abstract or anything like that. So it's got like a kind of a narrative hook going on in it as well. I think that's all I'm going to say about it. It kind of has lots of autobiographical elements in it, but I won't tell you which ones they are. It's also kind of works a lot with references. So one of the characters, there's like kind of like some references to contemporary cultures, like Netflix series and stuff like that in there. And then there's also some references to what I now call canonical avant-garde literature, like B.S. Johnson, you know that British novelist? So there's, I'm borrowing one of the villains from B.S. Johnson's book. So I'm doing lots of stuff like that as well, but you see. But actually, really, it's about queerness and class now. That's what it's doing. This first chapter is called War Crybabies. I look like 11 from Stranger Things. I'm 36. Similar hair, similar face, similar fears, in brackets, childhood terrors. I will not grow out my hair at the next opportunity, in brackets, season 2. Hello? Where am I? I'm alone on a beach, in brackets, what beach? It's early, it's cold, where's my blue worker's jacket? It's raining lightly, in brackets, a British beach. Hello? Where is everyone? Oh good, it's getting lighter over the Solent. In brackets, the stretch of water that separates the Isle of Wight from the British mainland. This is the Isle of Wight off the south coast of England, the beach outside Ryde. 1, 2, 3 Victorian military forts in the Solent, an early indication they have a thing about foreign invasions down here. Other than that, the beach is reassuringly pretty. Pinks and whites in this situation, ochres. I take in the sea air. So far, so good. But looking at the sea won't help. I have talents, I'll use them. A soldier, look. The soldier is wearing an army green t-shirt with black polar bears on it. What does it mean? Black oversized joggers, white Reebok, classic trainers. The pronoun is they. The soldier signals to include the black polar bears, the white Reeboks. Okay, I say. Like me, Shay, in brackets the soldier, the polar bears and the Reeboks are new to the Isle of Wight. They are second generation economic migrants, in brackets Shay, ecological refugees, in brackets the polar bears, and African elopers, I mean antelopes, in brackets the Reeboks, from northwest London. They are mobilizing to storm a fort in the Solent for military training purposes. Come, Shay asks. Yes, I reply wholeheartedly. My phone rings. Hello? According to the fraud detection team, someone, in brackets not me, attempted to pay £85 to PokerStars, then £500 to Paddy Power, in brackets betting sites, using my debit card. The fraud detection team cancelled my debit card with me on the beach. By the time I get off the phone, the moment to storm the fort has passed, we abort. The Isle of Wight is home to a large working class demographic. Shay, for one, works in a hotel in Ryde. Minimum wage rates, Shay says, but free board and lodging. Not bad as far as it goes. I have no money, no debit card. I interview for a job. This is the manager, house mother Normal, formerly of B.S. Johnson's eponymous novel from 1971 pertaining to British avant-garde literature. House mother Normal eyes me up. She looks unconvinced. Permission to work in the UK? Yes, in brackets, EU national. Ability to communicate effectively in English, so-so. Work experience, 20 years of it. In brackets, I have worked in all areas of the British hospitality and retail sectors. Kitchen, yes, in brackets, dying inside. When can you start? Yesterday. A styrofoam box containing raw squid and inky ice arrives in the kitchen. I get to it, I purge entire beaches and tiny digestive tracts from maritime bodies. Sand and intestines accumulate in the waste bucket. I'm building a private beach gutting squid. What if this were my beach? In brackets, sandy refuse collecting in a bucket. What if this were my storm? In brackets, my fort in the Solent. I drop a cocktail umbrella into the bucket. It's like a beach parasol, only it lies on its side. Freak weather events are fairly common on the Isle of Wight. Incidentally, the sea is yellow. In brackets, yellow for volatile. I'm not going in this, I say. The polar bears survey the coastline for a while. The Reeboks get halfway to the fort before they abort. Let's regroup tomorrow, she says. The polar bears are novelists, in brackets, infantry soldiers. The Reeboks are poets, in brackets, intelligence operatives. Given how busy Shay and I are, toiling, that's a beautiful thing. When they're not pursuing their aspirations, in brackets, writing, the novelists and poets like to gnaw on raw squid. I deposit a saucerful under the kitchen sink. No one will notice. Good morning. It's House Mother Normal patrolling her kitchen. I employ my foot to push the saucer of squid further under the kitchen sink where the polar bears and the Reeboks are hiding with bated breath. Cut triangles, that's it, House Mother Norman says. Nice and even. Then the arms, or is it tentacles? Yeah. Pieces like hula skirts. Ha ha. Put one round your finger like this. Crikey, a lot of waste in your bucket. Can you make soup? Don't bother rinsing. Just boil the lot. The sand will sink to the bottom of its own accord. About your contract, House Mother Norman says. Yes, I'm all ears. We'll keep it under the tax threshold, shall we? No national insurance contributions, no sick pay, no holidays. Okay, I say, in brackets, not okay. The original B.S. Johnson's House Mother Normal is in charge of a fictional nursing home. She has sidelines on the go, like watering down vodka or altering the labeling of penicillin bottles for underhand profit. She exploits and abuses those in her care. I want you to pour about a quarter of these bottles into one of the empty ones here until it's three quarters full, she says to an elderly resident at one point. Three bottles, pour a quarter out of, that is, until this one's also three quarters full. And when you've got them all three quarters full, then top them up with water from your tap. The recreational activities she provides are, if anything, worse. There's the pass the parcel game, in brackets, roll the dice when a six comes up, put on a hat and oven gloves quick as you can, and hack away at the parcel until you either attain the gift of chocolate inside or someone else throws a six, whatever comes first. Turns out there's no chocolate inside this parcel, only dog shit. That's B.S. Johnson, actually. Only dog shit. Violent character is B.S. Johnson's House Mother Normal. But B.S. Johnson violates House Mother Normal in turn, putting her through a public masturbation, I mean bestiality scene, with dog Ralphie, not once, not twice, but nine times over the course of the novel. Ghastly, really, but funny. Funny's important. It was a different time. Some B.S. there, B.S. Johnson. Funnily enough, this is now. This isn't a nursing home in 70s London, this is a no-star hotel in present-day Ryde. Like B.S. Johnson's, our House Mother Normal is a bully and exploiter. But if she has the original's entrepreneurial flair and resourcefulness, then so do we. We have talents, we'll use them. And who knows who's got what sexual kinks? No one knows, least of all me. I'm only new.
I'm petrified of House Mother Normal.
Yeah, I'm petrified of hunger.
I'm also petrified of the Isle of Wight after reading that. So, can I ask you a question first?
Yeah, go on.
So, I'm really fascinated by why you chose to set it on the Isle of Wight. And also, so the narrator is unnamed.
Yeah.
Or you call, is, so I, in my head, I say 11.
Yeah.
So 11. So what I was really interested in was A, why you set it there.
Yeah.
But B, I mean,
yeah, I say it.
Okay.
Say the word.
I didn't want to ruin the spoilers. So for me, so when this book came out, I was really raving about it on Twitter and stuff because, and the first thing I said on Twitter was, while everyone is wringing their hands about writing a Brexit novel, basically Isabel just did it in a really amazing. It is so. A, it's just a really amazing work of fiction, but I just love how it's just so set in a very specific political cultural moment. So my question to you really is, could you do, A, why did you set it in the EI of White, because I'm obsessed, but B, do you think that actually you could have taken that story outside of this particular moment, or was the moment dictated by the story of those two and vice versa?
Yeah, good question. Because they hang together.
Yeah, very much so.
That's a really good question. So the reason why I chose the Isle of Wight, and I am sort of, I'm using the Isle of Wight particularly to explore class. That's sort of what I, that's like the serious response to it. I know it well because my partner's from down there. She's from Portsmouth, so I go there actually regularly. But kind of these British seaside towns, they kind of occupy this really kind of mythical place in the British psyche, I found. And there's like, but at the same time, the Isle of Wight is like, it's been really suffering, you know, under two Tory governments. This place is totally disinvested and the huge working class population, the place is falling to pieces. So I'm kind of like setting the whole story there because we have that kind of really neglected sort of provincial setting of the Isle of Wight. But that at the same time, that's something that other provincial places don't do because it's set by the sea. So it also has really rich people still having their summer homes there. So it's like the discrepancy, the class discrepancy that's happening there on this like really small scale and like some sort of micro scale is what I think makes it attractive as a setting. Also, it's the place that has the least, in terms of Brexit, like, sorry for saying the word. it's got the least... It's the place with the least immigration in the whole of the UK, and it's got one of the highest Brexit votes. So it's like...
What a surprise.
You know? What a surprise. So, yeah, I guess that's the response to that.
Can I ask you a question about your book? So reading it, one, it's so witty, but also I'm just so interested in how your mind works when you're writing, because these things, like objects kind of appear. It actually really reminded me of like old video games. It's quite That's glitchy cool. And then kind of objects appear and they're kind of totems and then they disappear. I love it. But what is your writing process? Like how do you construct that? And because things seem to kind of just come through your consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And it's kind of like the simple answer is, I guess like both you guys, it's like more like it's not so much of a process, it's like a practice that developed over so many years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm like in my mid-40s now and I've been doing this kind of writing since my mid-late 20s, and it's just kind of developed in this way. And it does do so, I guess I trained my mind. It goes off on constant tangents, but I at the same time sort of want to pursue particular projects, in this case to explore Brexit in relation to queerness and class. So it has like a narrative, but the narrative is not really
linear.
It's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
Thanks for that question.
No, can I kind of ask you the same question? Because I'm interested in the form of your book as well. I love the, without doing a spoiler, but there's like a bit in the middle that's so amazing, which is the part, it's like a whole chapter from the perspective. I know it's kind of in a wee, but it's kind of from the perspective of the bogan caller.
Yeah.
And it's so genius and funny.
Well, basically, I knew quite early on that it was sort of going to be a novel of voices and that the collective voice was going to be sort of the dominant thing through it. But it's quite an intense voice, and that you can't really sustain that through a whole novel. Mm. So half the book is narrated by the mothers as the we, and as the protest is happening. And then the other half is narrated by a guy called Teddy, who's basically one of the children who the mothers has given shelter in the voguing houses over the years. And he basically goes to college and ends up working for the city. And his way of trying to pay the mothers back for the sort of shelter that they've given is to find a way to protect them through things like city policy and infrastructure.
But that's sort of, that's written in a he, so basically you get a far more kind of direct line to the sort of mindset of what it would be like to shelter, to, you know, to have that, you know, because it's not that family and chosen family, so you have sort of a parent side and a child side. But then in the middle of that, because it's based around ball culture, but it's not really a novel about voguing per se, it just, I wanted to write about the balls in a way that didn't necessarily feel that predictable. And, you know, those kind of novels have been done and that wasn't, you know, really interesting to me. But because it's a novel about voices, I'm really obsessed with Vogue callers generally. You know, it's very much, you know, from the same sort of vibe as, say, like a hip-hop MC. So it's about really about thinking on your feet. It's about wordplay. It's about, you know, obviously for queer culture, it's about reading. So that became a really important part of the book. So there's just a couple of chapters, sections in the middle of the book that sort of punctuate this narrative where you have a Vogue caller sort of just, you know, Vogue calling, basically. And they come at sort of specific stages in the book that sort of delineate kind of a sort of a past memory of what that culture was when they were at their prime. Because a lot of the book is about, you know, they're like mini King Lears. It's very much about sort of lament. They're sort of trying to tackle injustice in their community, but it's also on a more personal level, really about the sort of lessening of their own power as they get older, because, you know, children grow up and move away. So it's very much about that sort of readdressing how they find their power again and to fight against what they feel as sort of, you know, the invisibility as you go sort of through and past middle age.
But to follow up on, I think one of the things that really interested me about your book and what I think is really inspired and that I haven't seen done in a way at all, and there's tons of things about it, but I think it's, so basically you're using ballroom culture, but you're not writing about it, how it developed in the 80s or 90s. That's like kind of like the narrative that we're sort of become used to, like, you know, like poses on TV now, things like that, like Paris is burning, probably everybody has. Lots of people have seen by now.
And you can't improve on that.
No,
that,
and also...
And why would you want
what,
to? You
what's
know,
super interesting is then also like you kind of then... So you set it in now, but that also means that like the main characters, or at least some of them, the mothers, they are now more aged. They're like older now.
Yeah.
And this is kind of so interesting because we've got such a like obsession with youth in queer culture that I think the idea that like in a way the aging queens are sort of foregrounded. Mm. You know, like this is the kind of figure that normally is totally forgotten, like the aging queen, like it's like a classic stereotype, you know, they're now at home, like addicted to opioids or something
that.
You know, that stereotype, I mean, you really like foreground these characters, and we don't see that anywhere in popular culture really, like.
But they still, I mean, you talk about this in your book as well, you know, those kind of, I don't want to say elders, but you know, the people who came before you.
Yeah.
Still, you know, in terms of what they pass forward and what they still represent to the community is still like a massive, massive thing.
I agree.
So, yeah, I really felt that it had to come from those voices in that way, but also because I was really interested for a really long time in writing about a religious order. You know, particularly thinking a lot about like Cistercian monks and, you know, like, you know, the apostles before the gospels, that whole thing. And this was really my way of channeling that because I want it to feel that it has this sort of, that it feels like a movement. I don't want to say brotherhood, but it feels like a sort of movement. I remember when, hideous name drop, when my friend Max Porter read it, and he said, the first thing he said to me was, it feels like the private diaries of like saints. And I was like, that's exactly the sort of thing. You know what I mean? They're sort of older, they're wounded, but they're like one sort of critical mass, and that's kind of how I wanted it to speak.
And that's...
Because we don't have that in queer culture, so I wanted to use it and frame it in that kind of way.
Because it's got this like sort of elegiac, is that the word? Like it's got like some sort of a kind of like almost a religious...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tone, like when the mothers speak, like they sort of preach, like in don't they in a way?
I wanted it to feel that it was sort of a bit sort of otherworldly, and also because they do go through this sort of late stage religious conversion where, because they've never been able to find out why half these children have disappeared, and they've tried to explain it every other way, they end up going back to where they started from as children and just going into churches, not because they're particularly religious, but again, I was interested in that thing of what it is with people who are, you know, and I'm not religious in any way, but I'm always interested in what is it with people who have to find a reason to turn to religion when they can't find any other explanation, and they're already... you know, they're more humanist anyway, so I'm interested in that kind of thing. And that has influenced them in that particular action, and actually just in how they carry and how they speak, because they understand the power of speaking in that one voice.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you actually about the character Teddy, who I guess, not that it really has like main characters, but I guess Teddy is, for want of a better term.
Yeah. I mean, it is his book in a lot of ways, I think, yeah. In terms of how you can, as a reader, really find something to kind of identify.
Yeah, and I guess I really did identify with that, because I felt like that was quite a strong link between both our books, which is that Teddy is this figure that's part of the establishment, but also kind of comes from this, like, more kind of marginalised
group
of people. And I wondered whether you kind of felt any affinity with him, because I know that you wrote from experience, and that's why you've got the language so right, because you were part of these like clubbing scenes or experienced that, but then also have this sort of privilege of that you're the person that's able to write this down and get this published, so you kind of negotiate these two worlds in the same way as Teddy, maybe, but I don't know if that's really going into it.
I never thought of it that way.
No.
I think, you know, when I'm writing, I'm always thinking about overall in terms of like how it balances tonally, and they just really balanced each other, and his story needed to be told in a very sort of direct way in terms of his lived experience of being taken in by the mothers and, you know, being allowed to sort of flourish in life, because the narrative normally is that actually, and, you know, half the story of the book is obviously about the kids who didn't flourish, who disappeared or who left, you know, whatever. So I kind of wanted to show that, and really to show kind of, you're right, that kind of struggle in terms of how do you pay a debt that you feel that you cannot repay to your own community? You know, when you talk about that in your book, so that amazing chapter about gentrification where you talk about the joiners, then you have this amazing conversation with our mutual friend Jeffrey Hinton, who's obviously been around for years, and for a lot of people is someone who basically just gives you so much in terms of learning about what the culture is and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's very, very similar. Why did you decide to do it that way? Because you could have just written it about literally a very linear kind of the fight for the joiners. And actually, which is what I like about the whole book, actually, is how the way you've picked... Actually, let me rephrase that. How did you pick the people to be in the book? Because what I really like about it is the way the people that you have pulled in through lots of, you know, lots of different sections in terms of ages, diversities, all that kind of stuff. And they all offer different things, and they have this massive space in which to really speak their truth, which I think is, you know, and you don't intervene in that. I think it's really amazing. So how did you decide to do it in that way?
Well, I guess the basic structure of the book is kind of like the pros of increased equality or acceptance or mainstreaming, so things like same-sex marriage and what it means to have more choice. Then I look at the kind of drawbacks. That's where Gay Bar's chapter comes in. It's like, what kind of erasure do we get through the mainstreaming of culture? Like, for example, queer spaces closing. And then it's how far does that idea of equality really extend? So I go to places like Turkey where it's not illegal, homosexuality is not illegal, but, you know, it's like really driven underground and violence is quite rife. So that's the basic structure. And then in each chapter, I pick a location and a story about our mainstreaming or a story within that. And then on top of that, I kind of just picked things I'd written about before in my work as a journalist. So I'd written about trans models before. So in the chapter, I go to explore trans model agencies and media visibility, something I'd written about, so I had some connections. And then also I chose places where maybe I knew someone so that I could sleep on their sofa and save a bit of money.
But it comes across like that as well. So there's like this method of, there's always you are kind of like the connecting factor. Obviously.
Yeah, your personal narrative as it runs through the book is really brilliant.
Yeah, just the only place I really pitched up and I didn't know anyone or know what I was doing was Serbia for going to Belgrade Pride. And I found that when I turned up somewhere and I said, I want to explore what Pride is like in Belgrade, and I kind of contacted a couple of journalists and LGBT organisations, and people were so forthcoming, especially there, because their stance was like the international LGBT community aren't interested in us or aren't interested in Eastern Europe and how far behind things are. So everyone was really helpful. And people were also helpful because they just kind of got the project and were interested in the conversation. I think that the main thing I learned writing it was that as much sort of mainstreaming or assimilation is going on, we're still this LGBT family, and people just sort of say, you're queer, I'm queer, cool, I'm going to help you. And that was probably the most heartening thing about writing the book.
And that really comes through. That felt really positive.
And that's one of the questions that I wanted to ask you. So how do you see, do you think there still is such a thing as queer community, LGBTQI community? And is that now, do you see, like, say, do you think there's still like a London queer scene, so to speak? And like now you talk like that, we've talked about the closure of all these places. Mm. Does it kind of look differently, or what do you feel about that?
I think as we've become more conscious of sort of intersectionality as well, we see this like smaller groupings of people. And in some ways that's quite sad, and in some ways that's a good thing. Like it's good that sort of smaller groups with things in common are finding one another. And I think the bigger things like Pride get, or the more corporate things like gay bars get, if you look at like the GAY like franchise, like a chain, there's always a backlash to that, and there will always be sort of new things arising or splinter event. So I think Pride is a really, really good example, and it's Pride Month, so it feels relevant to talk about it, I guess, which is so many of us feel quite grossed out when we go to London Pride because there's these big banks or there's things like BAE Systems or UKIP there, and it just feels a bit gross, basically, just on an emotional level. But then, you know, so people don't want to go, but then they start new things, and I think that's really amazing and important. It's just been announced that there's going to be London Trans Pride. Got something called Queer Picnic, which is just a picnic in a park, because it's a bit more sort of quiet if you're introverted, or accessible if you have a disability. Or
that's an interesting comment, because that's what I found as well, because somehow it seems to move away a little bit like from bars and club culture. And as I said, I'm doing this event, Queer Readers, but I'm doing kind of a few events, and they're packed. And I've really, for the last 2-3 years, really seen that there's a kind of a younger generation of queers, but actually it's all sort of age ranges, and they want to come to things like to reading, to queer readings, to sort of that's kind of seems to be really the thing that people are excited about.
Mm. Yeah, it's now sort of, there's an appetite, definitely. Yeah.
And that's how you find your people. You know, you go to lots of different things, and you kind of find your community that way. So sorry, this really links in. So what you were saying about, you know, how Pride being corporate and people like UKIP being there, there's an amazing section, thread that runs through your book, which is about, you know, in terms of the queer community in the Isle of Wight, and this thread that runs through about the sort of right-wing young queers who join things like UKIP and EDF and start protesting, and then at the end the switch to the Tories. Yeah. Where did that come from? Yeah. I mean, it was really stuck out.
So there's obviously this. So this is everybody in the novel is working class. So there isn't. I'm not definitely, and in no way am I doing like the middle class liberal as opposed to the working class UKIP person. Yeah, this is something I'm completely displacing because I'm a working class person, and if I'm 11, then that's what it is. So there are just different working class queers in there that end up having different sort of there's tensions between them, because some of the queers, there are the UKIP queers. They sort of come up and they're sort of threatening my characters with sort of, they're sort of like also an enemy. Like, there's quite a lot of enemies. This House Mother Norman is just one of them. The others are sort of the more sort of right-wing queers. Yeah, and they end up switching to the Tories, because this is, I don't know where the inspiration come from, but I guess there are some younger ones, and then at some point they're like, okay, but we've just done that for a while. We've heard about, you know, UKIP from my dad, and then they want to actually, I think it says they decided to just join the Tories because there's better career. They might go into politics professionally and there's better career options, something like that. So this, I mean, this connection. I know the Tories aren't UK, but I'd say it's sort of a sliding slope.
But that narrative was a really fascinating narrative. And it also really reminds me of the Pasolini novel, Ragazzi.
Oh, that's
with those kind of hoods, those little hood boys who just kind of have their own kind of arc in terms of how their allegiances move.
Yeah.
You know, based on... the wider conflicts that are going on with bigger, more dominant groups. And it's really how those small groups really just sort of navigate through and find their own power. I thought it was amazing.
So that's correct, yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you was, so that your book has loads of references, and it's a really amazing sort of reference section at the back. You know, I love there was a bit where, you know, you reference this amazing Dennis Cooper article on how to build a pride flow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you talk about, you know, there's a cameo from Tonya Harding.
Oh, yeah.
There's a there's a really great reference to Walter Van Beer and Donk's Bear collection. That's such an amazing look. I mean, did you ever think, I mean, you know, you're a sort of fiction writer through and through, but did you ever think that actually at any point this could have been an avant-garde non-fiction book?
Yeah,
just
based
on the amount of, you know, sources within this material that you constantly quote.
That's kind of really interesting. Yeah, that's better than I could have said it. So in a way, yeah, it's a fiction book, but it's a non-fiction book at the same time, because I borrow so many figures from real life and so many references that it almost is a non-fiction book. Maybe it's a completely non-fiction book because the other parts are autobiographical.
Yeah.
So it is a lot, it appears to be a fiction book, let's put it like that. But it sort of works across these distinctions, I guess. In my entire work, I've set myself the task to work across many sort of embedded distinctions that we've gotten used to in literature. So I'm working across this idea of there being a proper dualism between fiction and non-fiction. I'm working across it. I'm working across this idea of there being like a high culture, like literature, and a low culture, like Netflix. I'm on purpose sort of bringing them both in to sort of destabilize these sort of distinctions, because... you could argue they're also classist, aren't they? So you want to sort of work across them a little bit. So.
And also, it reminded me a lot of in form, but it sort of exceeded the form, when Gordon Byrne wrote a novel called Born Yesterday, which was sort of mid-noughties. And it was a novel based on the news. And everyone's like, this is how novels are going to be. Someone's literally going to write a novel in a month based on what was happening. And you've kind of taken that form in a way, you know, and it sort of transcended in terms of, you know, because it's a mixture of lots of different things. Mm. But, you know, you could put that next to each other, they would hold up incredibly well.
Oh,
but what you do is you put it on a wider canvas, because, you know, in terms of how we think of literature, it's really sort of moved on how people accept what a novel is, you know, different, for sure. Mm.
So I guess we're kind of all doing that, though. Like, your book is super contemporary as well.
Yeah, I guess the challenge writing it was, how do I write this so it doesn't date before it even comes out? Because especially as Trump just does like something completely horrific to do with LGBT rights like every 2 weeks. So that was definitely something I was thinking about, especially as it sort of sits within nonfiction, whereas like maybe it's not such a concern for you because it doesn't. So,
But do you not think it's important that it should feel that it is of this particular moment? Because I think what this book does is, I think it sits very firmly in the sense that this is this particular moment, but it's not weighed down by cultural references that will date. I think that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, I think my way around that whole thing about it dating was, I'm going to talk to people about their lives and their stories, and it's not going to be like, you know, this happened yesterday. It's going to be, how does it feel to experience transphobia? And there is, you know, there's statistics and stuff in there, but it's much more about the individuals and the characters. That was a way to stop it dating, but it was also a way for hopefully more people to sort of access these people's stories, because I definitely didn't want to write something that was only read by LGBTQ people. I wanted straight people, cis people to be able to read it and feel like it wasn't... It was accessible to them, and it also wasn't sort of exclusionary, because I'm not really interested in preaching to the converted.
But you still give a lot to the converted.
Yeah. But you know, that's like,
the interview with Kian LaBeija, you know what I mean? I thought that was
Yeah.
You know, that was really beautiful.
Yeah, there are definitely some chapters where we've got some topic overlap. So there's a chapter where I speak to the mother of a voguing house. She's called Keila Beja. She's also an artist. Yeah, she's a voguer. She's an artist about language that's used in ballrooms and voguing communities and how that's kind of passed through, like, I don't know, like RuPaul and Beyonce and Broad City into the popular consciousness, and these forms of cultural appropriation and taking from ballroom culture. So there's that overlap. And then there's also a part in the book, which is in the same chapter as I speak to Kia, where I go to the Anti-Violence Project in New York, which is a charity that fights homophobic and transphobic violence, and speak to an organizer there called Lala Zanel, who is a black trans woman, and she's mostly working on the front lines of fighting transphobic violence in America. And the year that I interviewed her, 2017, it was like 26 trans people were murdered in America. And so it's also talking about invisibility, and basically we have all these trans models, and we have trans people walking down runways, and we have trans people in front of magazines like Time. But actually, if you're not famous, there's a massive disconnect. There's this horrific epidemic of violence. So I think that's an overlap, really, because it's talking about invisibility, and that's something you explore.
And about class and POC violence.
Who has a voice?
Gentrification against working class, POC. There's a lot of overlap between all of us.
Yeah, for sure.
So this is, I think we've reached the question segment.
Perfect.
Of the evening. Who would like to ask us anything?
You've all talked about elements of cultural appropriation in terms of queer culture, and as it becomes more mainstream, so things like RuPaul or the Met Gala does camp. Do you think there's a concern that queer people, and younger queer people in particular, will lose sight of like the history of it, and that the idea of like a specifically uniquely queer culture is sort of on the decline unless you find some kind of way to reclaim the history of it? I don't know what that would be, but some way of reclaiming the history of queer culture.
Should I start?
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because one of the brilliant question, yeah, because one of the questions I was saying, was going to ask you is that you say it's a protest novel, and it is, and in a way it sort of combines two different registers of protest. Like one is the sit-in protest, and the other is obviously voguing itself, which is also like a form of protest,
isn't it?
And one of the questions I was going to ask you was whether we now need to, in a way, to resort back to sit-ins and to sort of more these kind of like forms of protest, because voguing itself has arguably lost is sort of radical potential in a way, or it's subversive potential. So that's one of the ways that sort of feeds with through the complete mainstreamification, I guess, of drag and specifically. But I would even just really briefly say, even in terms of like the things that have been really widely appropriated, like drag, I mean, here we've got like people like David Hoyle. Do you guys know David Hoyle? So there are still really radical drag happening. So whilst we have this sort of more mainstream and glossy form, there is like people that like Le Gâteau Chocolat, like there's still more underground drag going on, and there's still grassroots queer cultures happening all the time. So I think...
And also it's just a more visible way in for a lot of people. You know, if you're a teenager and the first time you ever heard camp was through the Met Gala, and that opened something up for you, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of gloss is always going to be there, and especially in terms of how you know, fashion and all those kind of things spend a lot of money, you know, and Drag Race is so big. But I mean, I said something the other day, like Drag Race essentially is like, you know, they're like the new pop stars. They're like complete sort of glamazon, you know, and that exists as a really amazing thing. But if Drag Race is your way of learning about how amazing David Hoyle is and being part of that scene, then that's, you know, that's pretty cool.
I think this is something I'm trying to explore in the book. Like, people have different definitions of what radical means. So to some people, same-sex marriage is the most radical thing of all, because it's like gay people are entering this institution. And to other people, it's like the ultimate sellout. And I think drag is another example of that. You know, some people think it's really radical that drag is sort of this Trojan horse, like RuPaul's Drag Race, like this Trojan horse that's sort of like sort of indoctrinated straight people into queer culture. And I went to the RuPaul's Drag Race convention in LA, and there were like Christian Republican people who go to church every week and watch RuPaul's Drag Race. And some people think that's really radical. And other people...
But it is. They spend their money on those drag queens and make all those drag queens really rich. I mean, that's...
Pretty amazing. But to go back to what you're saying, I think is also what I was saying earlier, which is like when something gets big or commercialised to a certain extent, there'll always be a backlash and there'll always be something new. And I think we've really seen that with drag. I do see this sort of Disneyfication of drag, especially at that convention where there's... It's like, it's literally Disneyland. There's kids dressed up as drag queens. People spending hundreds of pounds on drag merchandise. But what I've seen in London, as drag has got more and more popular, is more kind of radical or interesting or alternative forms of drag arise. Because as you get more competition, people have to get more original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So actually can be really exciting.
Yeah.
And it still has a real punk element to it. You know, that kind of mentality. It does. It's not, you know, it'd be really interesting to see how Drag Race over here actually really translates, considering that the scene here is actually quite radical and it really just springs up.
Are they going to do it?
Yeah. They filmed it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because obviously there's always a he in the drag scene. I guess there's always a lot of non-binary drag artists like Victoria Sin and Ray Filer.
So it'd be interesting to see from a UK perspective if they acknowledge that. I mean. Yeah. Great question.
Hello.
Hello.
It kind of ties in actually to that question. I was just thinking about, I wanted to ask you about the act of kind of archiving or kind of saving queer culture, and that, you know, archiving is always, you know, an act of like exclusion as well as inclusion, and it's traditionally done by institutions. So is there a way to archive queer culture, and should it be archived? You know, and it kind of ties into like an oral tradition, which is so important, but also completely ephemeral and can be lost so easily. So I was wondering if any of you had any thoughts on if we can and should archive queer.
I mean, I guess the three of us, to an extent, are archiving queer culture in our writing as well.
I really think of novels as, in terms of the queer voice as being, you know, each epoch. I mean, I was thinking a lot recently about... when I first started writing this book, I read a copy of Dennis Cooper's poems from like the mid-90s. And it sort of made me a bit sad because I really thought about when I first discovered people like Dennis Cooper and Dale Peck and Pat Califia and Kathy Acker when I was about sort of 16, 17, sort of in the early 90s. And I felt there was a real sort of plethora and a real wave of like prolific queer writing. And that was really angry, that had an agenda, that really wanted to say something and sort of really record its moment. And I sort of felt in the intervening years, especially sort of in the noughties, everything had got really cozy and I didn't really get a sense that that was there. Maybe in other art forms, but not in publishing. Mm-hmm. And I think what's been really interesting in the time that I've written this book, which took me like 5 years, is you can see how the publishing landscape has changed in terms of there does seem to be a wave of queer novelists, writers, poets and stuff, and who are not only supported within the publishing community, but have a reach within their community and beyond. And I think actually just that proliferation of books is, for me, what will be the next sort of archive in our overall canon.
Couldn't say it better myself. No, there has been. I've even written about this. This liberating the canon is precisely a little bit about this idea that there wasn't really any sort of lively queer writing happening in this country for a long, long time, and that this, or ever, arguably, you know, in terms of experimentation at the same time as queerness, there is really, it's a desert historically in Britain.
And also, I think it shows actually that what happens is, in terms of the cultures, we have to do it ourselves. You can't expect anyone else to do it. And I think, you know, that is...
That's like a characteristic
it's
of
It's entwined with the whole nation of creating art. I think if you're creating art constantly, after a while, you realise actually what you're doing has to contribute to something because no one else is actually going to archive it for you.
Yeah,
I would say that. I said that one thing that's quite interesting is, once you're starting to archive queer culture beyond your own experience, it becomes quite sort of complicated as well, because, you know, you have a responsibility to tell other people's stories. And also one thing I found was like, okay, how do I do this really broad book that's sort of a kind of primer on contemporary queer culture and speaks to all these different people and is as inclusive as possible without leaving anyone out? So I definitely want to sort of tackle things like the intersection of race and queerness for certain people, but then how do I tell those stories as like a middle class, cisgender, passing, white lesbian? And it can be quite difficult. And I don't know if that, I'm kind of interested actually, you know, telling other people's stories or creating other queer characters. Did you have anything to negotiate there? Because I had things to negotiate. And I guess the main thing I had to negotiate was like, do I feel like this person really wants to do this off their own back? Mm. And they really want to be in it, and they have a reason to be in it. And then I kind of felt like it was okay to sort of tell their story.
So there's like an ethics involved in archiving.
Yeah, something you have to think about.
Archiving other people's stories.
Yeah, definitely.
I guess that doesn't really factor in my case.
No. So. Not necessarily egotistical. I think you just do it and then worry about it afterwards.
I have to think about a lot, yeah.
11.
But the thing with yours is what I said earlier, is because you basically, the voices are so strong, it feels like they are literally telling you their story. But unfettered by, you know, it doesn't feel like it's been edited in that way. That's how it should feel.
Yeah, I guess I think it was Victoria Sin. I met up with them at the beginning and was like, we were having a chat, and I was like, oh, like, how do I write the story of like queer people of colour? And then Victoria was like, just shut up and listen, and just like, don't talk. I mean, that was the advice.
Yeah, pretty great.
I mean, the ethics only comes in if you write down, like if you tell the story of somebody who is in a less powerful position than you. So I don't have that problem hardly ever. So I usually write about stories that are more powerful. I sort of borrow people's stories who are more powerful than me, who might be like more middle class than me. I'd be careful of writing a black or brown person's experience because so there are ethics involved and you make a decision every single time, isn't it?
Thanks. This is for Isabel. I wanted to ask, although you said that you feel like the ethics doesn't really apply because you're not writing down about people, with the liberating the canon, how did you approach kind of like the ethical ethical thoughts of who is it that will be included in your book, liberating the canon?
That's a good point, because that is obviously an actual archive. This edited book that I did, liberating the canon, and obviously I chose to include some writers that I arguably chose, but any same with the reading series Queers Read This, I guess. But I do, the whole point of liberating the canon is to include the writers who write the most innovative work, but who occupy the most traditionally marginalized subject positions, so to speak. So it is a lot of queers, a lot of working class people, a lot of transgender people, a lot of BAME people as well. But yeah, there's always going to be people left out, and that's why I need to do another one or something like that. Because yeah, there's always going to be at some point. But if I'm aware of them, and I'm quite aware of this field, that field that's actually really, like Niff was saying, there's really tons of exciting stuff happening in queer writing right now. And as I said, arguably for the first time properly, like in terms of like a wider, I don't want to use the word movement, but in terms of like a wider sort of development, that we actually have a British innovative writing scene.
Mm. And I think as someone who doesn't read much experimental, like avant-garde writing, liberating the canon was really quite a good in for me to like figure out what I like and what I don't like. And some stuff in it isn't that experimental, actually. It's quite narrative short story. Yeah. But it's like a good overview of what's going on, and the people that contributed are amazing.
Yeah.
So I would recommend it.
But did you think I've left people out in an awful way?
I didn't think that. I was just wondering how you chose, like whether it was, whether you had parameters that people had to meet to be able to.
Yeah, know that in a way. There seem to be people sort of in my sort of radar, but there's always going to be. Good point.
Given that you've all concurred that this is a sort of not a glorious time, but a time where there's more, but there's a time where more voices are being heard, is there not still a concern that those voices are going to be gatekept by the mainstream and there's going to be select voices? So what's the kind of battle?
Well, I mean, there is always a gatekeeper. I mean, you know, if you think about what's happening in publishing, for every one writer of colour that gets, you know, who gets the deal, there'll be another 10 whose books just don't. I mean, you know, I think the positive thing is that I just think that the gates are actually open, and I think there are people who, you know, there's just more people in decision-making processes, A, who are of colour or who are, you know, queer or whatever. So I just think, you know, if you're writing novels, for example, I think you can find people to send your novels to who you don't have the baggage of having to explain what your work is. And I think that's really an important thing. But also I think like independent publishing is a really important area, and I think the digital space has really changed. You know, when I first started writing, when I was sort of 18, 19, sort of late 80s, early 90s, you know, I was typing stuff out and sending it to people, and there wasn't really anywhere that you could even show people your work. And now there's just a way to actually just make yourself visible beyond just, okay, well, here's the novel, what am I going to do with it? There's just lots of things you can do. And I think actually what the digital space does gives writers autonomy, in the sense that you don't, you know, people feel that they don't need the gatekeepers, they can find their way without it.
What's your experience with independent publishing as well in that sense?
I've written an entire long essay about it. It's just gone, like, it's just been published last week. It's called Class, Queers and the Avant-Garde. So if somebody's really interested in these subject matters, because I still think that British publishing is extremely elitist, and we're just sort of getting there. I think it's pressure from readers. I think because there is, people want to read more diverse stuff, people want to read more innovative stuff. They don't necessarily... it's like this assumption that people only want to read a particular version of language that has been cultivated, but people actually want to read different stuff as well. And so I think I still think there's a lot of work to be done.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So we literally kind of just started, haven't we? And yeah, I'm publishing with an indie press. They're based in Manchester. And it's great. Yeah. It's great, but at the same time, I don't have many of the privileges that come with having a more commercial publisher at all. So it's a lot. My sort of success in book sales depend on people, grassroots readers, actually going out and buying this stuff. There's still a lot of class inequities, especially in publishing, but hopefully we get there, won't we?
Thank you all for
coming. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.